Physical geography was a subject in which he took great interest. The most important of his scientific writings is his General Natural History and Theory of the Heavens, 1755, which anticipates Laplace's nebula hypothesis and sets forth a possible origin of the solar system. Parts of this work have a remarkable Miltonic sublimity. It has the merit of inventing what proved a fruitful hypothesis, but it does not, as Laplace did, advance serious arguments in its favour. In parts, it is purely fanciful. For instance, in the doctrine that all planets are inhabited, and that the most distant planets have the best inhabitants, a view to be praised for its terrestrial modesty, but not supported by any scientific grounds. At a time when he was more troubled by the arguments of skeptics than he was earlier or later, he wrote a curious work called Dreams of a Ghost Seer, illustrated by the Dreams of Metaphysics, 1766. The ghost seer is Swedenborg, whose mystical system had been presented to the world in an enormous work, of which four copies were sold, three to unknown purchasers and one to Kant. Kant, half seriously and half in jest, suggests that Swedenborg's system, which he calls fantastic, is perhaps no more so than orthodox metaphysics. He is not, however, wholly contemptuous of Swedenborg. His mystical side, which existed, though it did not much appear in his writings, admired Swedenborg, whom he calls very sublime. Like everybody else at that time, he wrote a treatise on the sublime and the beautiful. Night is sublime, day is beautiful. The sea is sublime, the land is beautiful. Man is sublime, woman is beautiful, and so on. The Encyclopedia Britannica remarks that, as he never married, he kept the habits of his studious youth to old age. I wonder whether the author of this article was a bachelor or a married man. Kant's most important book is The Critique of Pure Reason, first edition 1781, second edition 1787. The purpose of this work is to prove that, although none of our knowledge can transcend experience, it is nevertheless in part a priori, and not inferred inductively from experience. The part of our knowledge which is a priori embraces, according to him, not only logic, but much that cannot be included in logic or deduced from it. He separates two distinctions, which in Leibniz are confounded. On the one hand, there is the distinction between analytic and synthetic propositions. On the other hand, the distinction between a priori and empirical propositions. Something must be said about each of these distinctions. An analytic proposition is one in which the predicate is part of the subject. For instance, a tall man is a man, or an equilateral triangle is a triangle. Such propositions follow from the law of contradiction. To maintain that a tall man is not a man would be self-contradictory. A synthetic proposition is one that is not analytic. All the propositions that we know only through experience are synthetic. We cannot, by a mere analysis of concepts, discover such truths as Tuesday was a wet day or Napoleon was a great general. But Kant, unlike Leibniz and all other previous philosophers, will not admit the converse, that all synthetic propositions are only known through experience. This brings us to the second of the above distinctions. An empirical proposition is one which we cannot know except by the help of sense perception, either our own or that of someone else whose testimony we accept. The facts of history and geography are of this sort. So are the laws of science, whenever our knowledge of their truth depends on observational data. An a priori proposition, on the other hand, is one which, though it may be elicited by experience, is seen, when known, to have a basis other than experience. A child learning arithmetic may be helped by experiencing two marbles, and two other marbles, and observing that altogether he is experiencing four marbles. But when he has grasped the general proposition, two and two are four, he no longer requires confirmation by instances. The proposition has a certainty which induction can never give to a general law. All the propositions of pure mathematics are in this sense a priori. Hume had proved that the law of causality is not analytic, and had inferred that we could not be certain of its truth. Kant accepted the view that it is synthetic, but nevertheless maintained that it is known a priori. He maintained that arithmetic and geometry are synthetic, but are likewise a priori. He was thus led to formulate his problem in these terms. How are synthetic judgments a priori possible? The answer to this question, with its consequences, constitutes the main theme of The Critique of Pure Reason. Kant's solution of the problem was one in which he felt great confidence. He had spent 12 years in looking for it, but took only a few months to write his whole long book after his theory had taken shape. In the preface to the first edition, he says, "I venture to assert that there is not a single metaphysical problem which has not been solved, or for the solution of which the key, at least, has not been supplied." In the preface to the second edition, he compares himself to Copernicus and says that he has effected a Copernican revolution in philosophy. According to Kant, the outer world causes only the matter of sensation, but our own mental apparatus orders this matter in space and time and supplies the concepts by means of which we understand experience. Things in themselves, which are the causes of our sensations, are unknowable. They are not in space or time. They are not substances, nor can they be described by any of those other general concepts which Kant calls categories. Space and time are subjective. They are part of our apparatus of perception. But just because of this, we can be sure that whatever we experience will exhibit the characteristics dealt with by geometry and the science of time. If you always wore blue spectacles, you could be sure of seeing everything blue. This is not Kant's illustration. Similarly, since you always wear spatial spectacles in your mind, you are sure of always seeing everything in space. Thus, geometry is a priori in the sense that it must be true of everything experienced. But we have no reason to suppose that anything analogous is true of things in themselves, which we do not experience. Space and time, Kant says, are not concepts. They are forms of intuition. The German word is Anschauung, which means literally looking at or view. The word intuition, though the accepted translation, is not altogether a satisfactory one. There are also, however, a priori concepts. These are the 12 categories which Kant derives from the forms of the syllogism. The 12 categories are divided into 4 sets of 3. 1. Of quantity. Unity, plurality, totality. 2. Of quality. Reality, negation, limitation. 3. Of relation. Substance and accident, cause and effect, reciprocity. 4. Of modality. Possibility, existence, necessity. These are subjective in the same sense in which space and time are, that is to say, our mental constitution is such that they are applicable to whatever we experience. But there is no reason to suppose them applicable to things in themselves. As regards cause, however, there is an inconsistency. For things in themselves are regarded by Kant as causes of sensations, and free volitions are held by him to be causes of occurrences in space and time. This inconsistency is not an accidental oversight. It is an essential part of his system. A large part of the Critique of Pure Reason is occupied in showing the fallacies that arise from applying space and time or the categories to things that are not experienced. When this is done, so Kant maintains, we find ourselves troubled by antinomies, that is to say, by mutually contradictory propositions, each of which can apparently be proved. Kant gives 4 such antinomies, each consisting of thesis and antithesis. In the first, the thesis says, "The world has a beginning in time and is also limited as regards space." The antithesis says, "The world has no beginning in time and no limits in space. It is infinite as regards both time and space." The second antinomy proves that every composite substance both is and is not made up of simple parts. The thesis of the third antinomy maintains that there are 2 kinds of causality, one according to the laws of nature, the other that of freedom. The antithesis maintains that there is only causality according to the laws of nature. The fourth antinomy proves that there is and is not an absolutely necessary being. This part of the critique greatly influenced Hegel, whose dialectic proceeds wholly by way of antinomies. In a famous section, Kant sets to work to demolish all the purely intellectual proofs of the existence of God. He makes it clear that he has other reasons for believing in God. These he was to set forth later in the Critique of Practical Reason, but for the time being his purpose is purely negative. There are, he says, only three proofs of God's existence by pure reason. These are the ontological proof, the cosmological proof, and the physico-theological proof. The ontological proof, as he sets it forth, defines God as the ens realissimum, the most real being, that is, the subject of all predicates that belong to being absolutely. It is contended by those who believe the proof valid that since existence is such a predicate, this subject must have the predicate existence, that is, must exist. Kant objects that existence is not a predicate. 100 thalers that I merely imagine may, he says, have all the same predicates as 100 real thalers. The cosmological proof says, if anything exists, then an absolutely necessary being must exist. Now I know that I exist, therefore an absolute necessary being exists, and this must be the ens realissimum. Kant maintains that the last step in this argument is the ontological argument over again, and that it is therefore refuted by what has been already said. The physico-theological proof is the familiar argument from design, but in a metaphysical dress. It maintains that the universe exhibits an order which is evidence of purpose. This argument is treated by Kant with respect, but he points out that, at best, it proves only an architect, not a creator, and therefore cannot give an adequate conception of God. He concludes that the only theology of reason which is possible is that which is based upon moral laws or seeks guidance from them. God, freedom, and immortality, he says, are three ideas of reason. But although pure reason leads us to form these ideas, it cannot itself prove their reality. The importance of these ideas is practical, that is, connected with morals. The purely intellectual use of reason leads to fallacies. Its only right use is directed to moral ends. The practical use of reason is developed briefly near the end of the Critique of Pure Reason and more fully in the Critique of Practical Reason, 1786. The argument is that the moral law demands justice, that is, happiness proportional to virtue. Only providence can ensure this, and has evidently not ensured it in this life. Therefore, there is a God and a future life, and there must be freedom, since otherwise there would be no such thing as virtue. Kant's ethical system, as set forth in his Metaphysic of Morals, 1785, has considerable historical importance. This book contains the categorical imperative, which, at least as a phrase, is familiar outside the circle of professional philosophers. As might be expected, Kant will have nothing to do with utilitarianism, or with any doctrine which gives to morality a purpose outside itself. He wants, he says, a completely isolated metaphysic of morals, which is not mixed with any theology or physics or hyperphysics. All moral concepts, he continues, have their seat and origin wholly a priori in the reason. Moral worth exists only when a man acts from a sense of duty. It is not enough that the act should be such as duty might have prescribed. The tradesman who is honest from self-interest, or the man who is kind from benevolent impulse, is not virtuous. The essence of morality is to be derived from the concept of law. For though everything in nature acts according to laws, only a rational being has the power of acting according to the idea of a law, that is, by will. The idea of an objective principle, in so far as it is compelling to the will, is called a command of the reason, and the formula of the command is called an imperative. There are two sorts of imperative. The hypothetical imperative, which says, you must do so and so if you wish to achieve such and such an end, and the categorical imperative, which says that a certain kind of action is objectively necessary, without regard to any end. The categorical imperative is synthetic and a priori. Its character is deduced by Kant from the concept of law. If I think of a categorical imperative, I know at once what it contains. For as the imperative contains, besides the law, only the necessity of the maxim to be in accordance with this law, but the law contains no condition by which it is limited, Nothing remains over but the generality of a law in general, to which the maxim of the actions is to be conformable, and which conforming alone presents the imperative as necessary. Therefore, the categorical imperative is a single one, and in fact this: act only according to a maxim by which you can at the same time will that it shall become a general law. Or, act as if the maxim of your action were to become, through your will, a general natural law. Kant gives us an illustration of the working of the categorical imperative that it is wrong to borrow money, because if we all try to do so, there would be no money left to borrow. One can in like manner show that theft and murder are condemned by the categorical imperative. But there are some acts which Kant would certainly think wrong, but which cannot be shown to be wrong by his principles. For instance, suicide. It would be quite possible for a melancholic to wish that everybody should commit suicide. His maxim seems, in fact, to give a necessary but not a sufficient criterion of virtue. To get a sufficient criterion, we should have to abandon Kant's purely formal point of view and take some account of the effects of actions. Kant, however, states emphatically that virtue does not depend upon the intended result of an action, but only on the principle of which it is itself a result. And if this is conceded, nothing more concrete than his maxim is possible. Kant maintains, although his principle does not seem to entail this consequence, that we ought so to act as to treat every man as an end in himself. This may be regarded as an abstract form of the doctrine of the rights of man, and it is open to the same objections. If taken seriously, it would make it impossible to reach a decision whenever two people's interests conflict. The difficulties are particularly obvious in political philosophy, which requires some principle, such as preference for the majority, by which the interests of some can, when necessary, be sacrificed to those of others. If there is to be any ethic of government, the end of government must be one, and the only single end compatible with justice is the good of the community. It is possible, however, to interpret Kant's principle as meaning not that each man is an absolute end, but that all men should count equally in determining actions by which many are affected. So interpreted, the principle may be regarded as giving an ethical basis for democracy. In this interpretation, it is not open to the above objection. Kant's vigor and freshness of mind in old age are shown by his treatise on Perpetual Peace, 1795. In this work, he advocates a federation of free states, bound together by a covenant forbidding war. Reason, he says, utterly condemns war, which only an international government can prevent. The civil constitution of the component states should, he says, be republican. But he defines this word as meaning that the executive and the legislative are separated. He does not mean that there should be no king. In fact, he says that it is easiest to get a perfect government under a monarchy. Writing under the impact of the Reign of Terror, he is suspicious of democracy. He says that it is of necessity despotism, since it establishes an executive power. The whole people, so-called, who carry their measures are really not all, but only a majority, so that here the universal will is in contradiction with itself and with the principle of freedom. The phrasing shows the influence of Rousseau, but the important idea of a world federation as the way to secure peace is not derived from Rousseau. Since 1933, this treatise has caused Kant to fall into disfavor in his own country. C. Kant's theory of space and time. The most important part of the Critique of Pure Reason is the doctrine of space and time. In this section, I propose to make a critical examination of this doctrine. To explain Kant's theory of space and time clearly is not easy, because the theory itself is not clear. It is set forth both in the Critique of Pure Reason and in the Prolegomena. The latter exposition is the easier, but is less full than that in the Critique. I will try first to expound the theory, making it as plausible as I can. Only after exposition will I attempt criticism. Kant holds that the immediate objects of perception are due partly to external things and partly to our own perceptive apparatus. Locke had accustomed the world to the idea that the secondary qualities, colours, sounds, smells, etc., are subjective, and do not belong to the object as it is in itself. Kant, like Berkeley and Hume, though in not quite the same way, goes further and makes the primary qualities also subjective. Kant does not at most times question that our sensations have causes, which he calls things in themselves or noumena. What appears to us in perception, which he calls a phenomenon, consists of two parts, that due to the object, which he calls the sensation, and that due to our subjective apparatus, which he says causes the manifold to be ordered in certain relations. This latter part he calls the form of the phenomenon. This part is not itself sensation, and therefore not dependent upon the accident of environment. It is always the same, since we carry it about with us, and it is a priori in the sense that it is not dependent upon experience. A pure form of sensibility is called a pure intuition, Anschauung. There are two such forms, namely space and time, one for the outer sense, one for the inner. To prove that space and time are a priori forms, Kant has two classes of arguments, one metaphysical, the other epistemological, or, as he calls it, transcendental. The former class of arguments are taken directly from the nature of space and time, the latter indirectly from the possibility of pure mathematics. The arguments about space are given more fully than those about time, because it is thought that the latter are essentially the same as the former. As regards space, the metaphysical arguments are four in number. 1. Space is not an empirical concept, abstracted from outer experiences. For space is presupposed in referring sensations to something external, and external experience is only possible through the presentation of space. 2. Space is a necessary presentation a priori, which underlies all external perceptions. For we cannot imagine that there should be no space, although we can imagine that there should be nothing in space. 3. Space is not a discursive or general concept of the relations of things in general, for there is only one space, of which what we call spaces are parts, not instances. 4. Space is presented as an infinite given magnitude, which holds within itself all the parts of space. This relation is different from that of a concept to its instances, and therefore space is not a concept, but an Anschauung. The transcendental argument concerning space is derived from geometry. Kant holds that Euclidean geometry is known a priori, although it is synthetic, that is, not deducible from logic alone. Geometrical proofs, he considers, depend upon the figures. We can see, for instance, that given two intersecting straight lines at right angles to each other, only one straight line at right angles to both can be drawn through their point of intersection. This knowledge, he thinks, is not derived from experience. But the only way in which my intuition can anticipate what will be found in the object is if it contains only the form of my sensibility, antedating in my subjectivity all the actual impressions. The objects of sense must obey geometry, because geometry is concerned with our ways of perceiving, and therefore we cannot perceive otherwise. This explains why geometry, though synthetic, is a priori and apodeictic. The arguments with regard to time are essentially the same, except that arithmetic replaces geometry with the contention that counting takes time. Let us now examine these arguments one by one. The first of the metaphysical arguments concerning space says, space is not an empirical concept abstracted from external experiences. For in order that certain sensations may be referred to something outside me, that is, to something in a different position in space from that in which I find myself, and further, in order that I may be able to perceive them as outside and beside each other, and thus as not merely different, but in different places, the presentation of space must already give the foundation, zum Grunde liegen. Therefore, external experience is only possible through the presentation of space. The phrase, outside me, that is, in a different place from that in which I find myself, is a difficult one. As a thing in itself, I am not anywhere, and nothing is spatially outside me. It is only my body as a phenomenon that can be meant. Thus, all that is really involved is what comes in the second part of the sentence, namely, that I perceive different objects as in different places. The image which arises in one's mind is that of a cloakroom attendant who hangs different coats on different pegs. The pegs must already exist, but the attendant's subjectivity arranges the coats. There is here, as throughout Kant's theory of the subjectivity of space and time, a difficulty which he seems to have never felt. What induces me to arrange objects of perception as I do, rather than otherwise? Why, for instance, do I always see people's eyes above their mouths and not below them? According to Kant, the eyes and the mouth exist as things in themselves and cause my separate percepts, but nothing in them corresponds to the spatial arrangement that exists in my perception. Contrast with this the physical theory of colours. We do not suppose that in matter there are colours in the sense in which our percepts have colours, but we do think that different colours correspond to different wavelengths. Since waves, however, involve space and time, there cannot, for Kant, be waves in the causes of our percepts. If, on the other hand, the space and time of our percepts have counterparts in the world of matter, as physics assumes, then geometry is applicable to these counterparts, and Kant's arguments fail. Kant holds that the mind orders the raw material of sensation, but never thinks it necessary to say why it orders it as it does, and not otherwise. In regard to time, this difficulty is even greater, because of the intrusion of causality. I perceive the lightning before I perceive the thunder. A thing in itself A caused my perception of lightning, and another thing in itself B caused my perception of thunder. But A was not earlier than B, since time exists only in the relations of percepts. Why, then, do the two timeless things, A and B, produce effects at different times? This must be wholly arbitrary if Kant is right, and there must be no relation between A and B corresponding to the fact that the percept caused by A is earlier than that caused by B. The second metaphysical argument maintains that it is possible to imagine nothing in space, but impossible to imagine no space. It seems to me that no serious argument can be based upon what we can or cannot imagine, but I should emphatically deny that we can imagine space with nothing in it. You can imagine looking at the sky on a dark, cloudy night, but then you yourself are in space, and you imagine the clouds that you cannot see. Kant's space is absolute, like Newton's, and not merely a system of relations. But I do not see how absolute empty space can be imagined. The third metaphysical argument says, space is not a discursive, or as is said, general concept of the relations of things in general, but a pure intuition. For in the first place, we can only imagine, sich vorstellen, one single space. And if we speak of spaces, we mean only parts of one and the same unique space. And these parts cannot precede the whole as its parts, but can only be thought of as in it. It, space, is essentially unique. The manifold in it rests solely on limitations. From this, it is concluded that space is an a priori intuition. The gist of this argument is the denial of plurality in space itself. What we call spaces are neither instances of a general concept, a space, nor parts of an aggregate. I do not know quite what, according to Kant, their logical status is, but in any case they are logically subsequent to space. To those who take, as practically all moderns do, a relational view of space, this argument becomes incapable of being stated, since neither space nor spaces can survive as a substantive. The fourth metaphysical argument is chiefly concerned to prove that space is an intuition, not a concept. Its premise is space is imagined, or presented, vorgestellt, as an infinite given magnitude. This is the view of a person living in a flat country, like that of Königsberg. I do not see how an inhabitant of an alpine valley could adopt it. It is difficult to see how anything infinite can be given. I should have thought it obvious that the part of space that is given is that which is peopled by objects of perception, and that for other parts we have only a feeling of possibility of motion. And if so vulgar an argument may be intruded, modern astronomers maintain that space is in fact not infinite, but goes round and round, like the surface of the globe. The transcendental or epistemological argument, which is best stated in the Prolegomena, is more definite than the metaphysical arguments, and is also more definitely refutable. Geometry, as we now know, is a name covering two different studies. On the one hand, there is pure geometry, which deduces consequences from axioms, without inquiring whether the axioms are true. This contains nothing that does not follow from logic, and is not synthetic, and has no need of figures such as are used in geometrical textbooks. On the other hand, there is geometry as a branch of physics, as it appears, for example, in the general theory of relativity. This is an empirical science, in which the axioms are inferred from measurements, and are found to differ from Euclid's. Thus, of the two kinds of geometry, one is a priori, but not synthetic, while the other is synthetic, but not a priori. This disposes of the transcendental argument. Let us now try to consider the questions raised by Kant as regards space in a more general way. If we adopt the view, which is taken for granted in physics, that our percepts have external causes which are, in some sense, material, we are led to the conclusion that all the actual qualities in percepts are different from those in their unperceived causes, but that there is a certain structural similarity between the system of percepts and the system of their causes. There is, for example, a correlation between colours, as perceived, and wavelengths, as inferred by physicists. Similarly, there must be a correlation between space as an ingredient in percepts and space as an ingredient in the system of unperceived causes of percepts. All this rests upon the maxim, same cause, same effect, with its obverse, different effects, different causes. Thus, for example, when a visual percept A appears to the left of a visual percept B, we shall suppose that there is some corresponding relation between the cause of A and the cause of B. We have, on this view, two spaces, one subjective and one objective, one known in experience and the other merely inferred. But there is no difference in this respect between space and other aspects of perception, such as colours and sounds. All alike in their subjective forms are known empirically. All alike in their objective forms are inferred by means of a maxim as to causation. There is no reason whatever for regarding our knowledge of space as in any way different from our knowledge of colour and sound and smell. With regard to time, the matter is different, since if we adhere to the belief in unperceived causes of percepts, the objective time must be identical with the subjective time. If not, we get into the difficulties already considered in connection with lightning and thunder. Or take such a case as the following. You hear a man speak, you answer him, and he hears you. His speaking and his hearing of your reply are both, so far as you are concerned, in the unperceived world. And in that world, the former precedes the latter. Moreover, his speaking precedes your hearing in the objective world of physics. Your hearing precedes your reply in the subjective world of percepts, and your reply precedes his hearing in the objective world of physics. It is clear that the relation precedes must be the same in all these propositions. While, therefore, there is an important sense in which perceptual space is subjective, there is no sense in which perceptual time is subjective. The above arguments assume, as Kant does, that percepts are caused by things in themselves, or, as we should say, by events in the world of physics. This assumption, however, is by no means logically necessary. If it is abandoned, percepts cease to be in any important sense subjective, since there is nothing with which to contrast them. The thing in itself was an awkward element in Kant's philosophy, and was abandoned by his immediate successors, who accordingly fell into something very like solipsism. Kant's inconsistencies were such as to make it inevitable that philosophers who were influenced by him should develop rapidly either in the empirical or in the absolutist direction. It was, in fact, in the latter direction that German philosophy moved until after the death of Hegel. Kant's immediate successor, Fichte, 1762 to 1814, abandoned things in themselves and carried subjectivism to a point which seems almost to involve a kind of insanity. He holds that the ego is the only ultimate reality, and that it exists because it posits itself, The non-ego, which has a subordinate reality, also exists only because the ego posits it. Fichte is not important as a pure philosopher, but as the theoretical founder of German nationalism, by his Addresses to the German Nation, 1807-8, which were intended to rouse the Germans to resistance to Napoleon after the Battle of Jena. The ego as a metaphysical concept easily became confused with the empirical Fichte. Since the ego was German, it followed that the Germans were superior to all other nations. To have character and to be a German, says Fichte, undoubtedly mean the same thing. On this basis, he worked out a whole philosophy of nationalistic totalitarianism which had great influence in Germany. His immediate successor, Schelling, 1775-1854, was more amiable, but not less subjective. He was closely associated with the German Romantics. Philosophically, though famous in his day, he is not important. The important development from Kant's philosophy was that of Hegel. Chapter 21. Currents of Thought in the 19th Century. The intellectual life of the 19th century was more complex than that of any previous age. This was due to several causes. First, the area concerned was larger than ever before. America and Russia made important contributions, and Europe became more aware than formerly of Indian philosophies, both ancient and modern. Second, science, which had been a chief source of novelty since the 17th century, made new conquests, especially in geology, biology, and organic chemistry. Third, machine production profoundly altered the social structure and gave men a new conception of their powers in relation to the physical environment. Fourth, a profound revolt, both philosophical and political, against traditional systems in thought, in politics, and in economics, gave rise to attacks upon many beliefs and institutions that had hitherto been regarded as unassailable. This revolt had two very different forms, one romantic, the other rationalistic. I am using these words in a liberal sense. The romantic revolt passes from Byron, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche to Mussolini and Hitler. The rationalistic revolt begins with the French philosophers of the Revolution, passes on, somewhat softened, to the philosophical radicals in England, then acquires a deeper form in Marx and issues in Soviet Russia. The intellectual predominance of Germany is a new factor, beginning with Kant. Leibniz, though a German, wrote almost always in Latin or French, and was very little influenced by Germany in his philosophy. German idealism after Kant, as well as later German philosophy, was, on the contrary, profoundly influenced by German history. Much of what seems strange in German philosophical speculation reflects the state of mind of a vigorous nation deprived, by historical accidents, of its natural share of power. Germany had owed its international position to the Holy Roman Empire, but the emperor had gradually lost control of his nominal subjects. The last powerful emperor was Charles V, and he owed his power to his possessions in Spain and the Low Countries. The Reformation and the Thirty Years' War destroyed what had been left of German unity, leaving a number of petty principalities which were at the mercy of France. In the 18th century, only one German state, Prussia, had successfully resisted the French. That is why Frederick was called the Great. But Prussia itself had failed to stand against Napoleon, being utterly defeated in the Battle of Jena. The resurrection of Prussia under Bismarck appeared as a revival of the heroic past of Alaric, Charlemagne, and Barbarossa. To Germans, Charlemagne is a German, not a Frenchman. Bismarck showed his sense of history when he said, "We will not go to Canossa." Prussia, however, though politically predominant, was culturally less advanced than much of Western Germany. This explains why many eminent Germans, including Goethe, did not regret Napoleon's success at Jena. Germany, at the beginning of the 19th century, presented an extraordinary cultural and economic diversity. In East Prussia, serfdom still survived. The rural aristocracy were largely immersed in bucolic ignorance, and the laborers were completely without even the rudiments of education. Western Germany, on the other hand, had been in part subject to Rome in antiquity. It had been under French influence since the 17th century. It had been occupied by French revolutionary armies and had acquired institutions as liberal as those of France. Some of the princes were intelligent, patrons of the arts and sciences, imitating Renaissance princes in their courts. The most notable example was Weimar, where the Grand Duke was Goethe's patron. The princes were, naturally, for the most part, opposed to German unity, since it would destroy their independence. They were therefore anti-patriotic, and so were many of the eminent men who depended on them, to whom Napoleon appeared the missionary of a higher culture than that of Germany. Gradually, during the 19th century, the culture of Protestant Germany became increasingly Prussian. Frederick the Great, as a free thinker and an admirer of French philosophy, had struggled to make Berlin a cultural center. The Berlin Academy had, as its perpetual president, an eminent Frenchman, Maupert Thuy, who, however, unfortunately became the victim of Voltaire's deadly ridicule. Frederick's endeavors, like those of the other enlightened despots of the time, did not include economic or political reform. All that was really achieved was a claque of hired intellectuals. After his death, it was again in Western Germany that most of the men of culture were to be found. German philosophy was more connected with Prussia than were German literature and art. Kant was a subject of Frederick the Great. Fichte and Hegel were professors at Berlin. Kant was little influenced by Prussia. Indeed, he got into trouble with the Prussian government for his liberal theology. But both Fichte and Hegel were philosophic mouthpieces of Prussia, and did much to prepare the way for the later identification of German patriotism with admiration for Prussia. Their work in this respect was carried on by the great German historians, particularly by Mommsen and Treitschke. Bismarck finally persuaded the German nation to accept unification under Prussia, and thus gave the victory to the less internationally minded elements in German culture. Throughout the whole period after the death of Hegel, most academic philosophy remained traditional, and therefore not very important. British empiricist philosophy was dominant in England until near the end of the century, and in France until a somewhat earlier time. Then gradually, Kant and Hegel conquered the universities of France and England, so far as their teachers of technical philosophy were concerned. The general educated public, however, was very little affected by this movement, which had few adherents among men of science. The writers who carried on the academic tradition, John Stuart Mill on the empiricist side, Lotze, Siegwart, Bradley and Bosanquet on the side of German idealism, were none of them quite in the front rank among philosophers. That is to say, they were not the equals of the men whose systems they, on the whole, adopted. Academic philosophy has often before been out of touch with the most vigorous thought of the age. For instance, in the 16th and 17th centuries, when it was still mainly scholastic. Whenever this happens, the historian of philosophy is less concerned with the professors than with the unprofessional heretics. Most of the philosophers of the French Revolution combined science with beliefs associated with Rousseau. Helvetius and Condorcet may be regarded as typical in their combination of rationalism and enthusiasm. Helvetius, 1715 to 1771, had the honor of having his book, De l'Esprit, 1758, condemned by the Sorbonne and burnt by the hangman. Bentham read him in 1769 and immediately determined to devote his life to the principles of legislation, saying, "What Bacon was to the physical world, Helvetius was to the moral. The moral world has therefore had its Bacon, but its Newton is still to come." James Mill took Helvetius as his guide in the education of his son, John Stuart. Following Locke's doctrine that the mind is a tabula rasa, Helvetius considered the differences between individuals entirely due to differences of education. In every individual, his talents and his virtues are the effect of his instruction. Genius, he maintains, is often due to chance. If Shakespeare had not been caught poaching, he would have been a wool merchant. His interest in legislation comes from the doctrine that the principal instructors of adolescence are the forms of government, and the consequent manners and customs. Men are born ignorant, not stupid. They are made stupid by education. In ethics, Helvetius was a utilitarian. He considered pleasure to be the good. In religion, he was a deist, and vehemently anti-clerical. In theory of knowledge, he adopted a simplified version of Locke. Enlightened by Locke, we know that it is to the sense organs we owe our ideas, and consequently our mind. Physical sensibility, he says, is the sole cause of our actions, our thoughts, our passions, and our sociability. He strongly disagrees with Rousseau as to the value of knowledge, which he rates very highly. His doctrine is optimistic, since only a perfect education is needed to make men perfect. There is a suggestion that it would be easy to find a perfect education if the priests were got out of the way. Condorcet, 1743 to 1794, has opinions similar to those of Helvetius, but more influenced by Rousseau. The rights of man, he says, are all deduced from this one truth, that he is a sensitive being, capable of making reasonings and acquiring moral ideas, from which it follows that men can no longer be divided into rulers and subjects, liars and dupes. These principles, for which the generous Sidney gave his life, and to which Locke attached the authority of his name, were afterwards developed more precisely by Rousseau. Locke, he says, first showed the limits of human knowledge. His method soon became that of all philosophers, and it is by applying it to morals, politics, and economics that they have succeeded in pursuing in these sciences a road almost as sure as that of the natural sciences. Condorcet much admires the American Revolution. Simple common sense taught the inhabitants of the British colonies that Englishmen born on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean had precisely the same rights as those born on the meridian of Greenwich. The United States Constitution, he says, is based on natural rights, and the American Revolution made the rights of man known to all Europe, from the Neva to the Guadalquivir. The principles of the French Revolution, however, are purer, more precise, deeper than those that guided the Americans. These words were written while he was in hiding from Robespierre. Shortly afterwards, he was caught and imprisoned. He died in prison, but the manner of his death is uncertain. He was a believer in the equality of women. He was also the inventor of Malthus's theory of population, which, however, had not for him the gloomy consequences that it had for Malthus, because he coupled it with the necessity of birth control. Malthus's father was a disciple of Condorcet, and it was in this way that Malthus came to know of the theory. Condorcet is even more enthusiastic and optimistic than Helvetius. He believes that, through the spread of the principles of the French Revolution, all the major social ills will soon disappear. Perhaps he was fortunate in not living beyond 1794. The doctrines of the French Revolutionary
Medical Mission to Biafra,
less enthusiastic and much more precise, were brought to England by the philosophical radicals, of whom Bentham was the recognized chief. Bentham was, at first, almost exclusively interested in law. Gradually, as he grew older, his interests widened and his opinions became more subversive. After 1808, he was a republican, a believer in the equality of women, an enemy of imperialism, and an uncompromising democrat. Some of these opinions he owed to James Mill. Both believed in the omnipotence of education. Bentham's adoption of the principle of the greatest happiness of the greatest number was no doubt due to democratic feeling, but it involved opposition to the doctrine of the rights of man, which he bluntly characterized as nonsense. The philosophical radicals differed from men like Helvetius and Condorcet in many ways. Temperamentally, they were patient and fond of working out their theories in practical detail. They attached great importance to economics, which they believed themselves to have developed as a science. Tendencies to enthusiasm, which existed in Bentham and John Stuart Mill, but not in Malthus or James Mill, were severely held in check by this science, and particularly by Malthus's gloomy version of the theory of population, according to which most wage earners must always, except just after a pestilence, earn the smallest amount that will keep them and their families alive. Another great difference between the Benthamites and their French predecessors was that in industrial England there was violent conflict between employers and wage earners, which gave rise to trades unionism and socialism. In this conflict, the Benthamites, broadly speaking, sided with the employers against the working class. Their last representative, John Stuart Mill, however, gradually ceased to give adherence to his father's stern tenets and became, as he grew older, less and less hostile to socialism and less convinced of the eternal truth of classical economics. According to his autobiography, this softening process was begun by the reading of the Romantic poets. The Benthamites, though at first revolutionary in a rather mild way, gradually ceased to be so, partly through success in converting the British government to some of their views, partly through opposition to the growing strength of socialism and trade unionism. Men who were in revolt against tradition, as already mentioned, were of two kinds, rationalistic and romantic, though in men like Condorcet, both elements were combined. The Benthamites were almost wholly rationalistic, and so were the socialists who rebelled against them, as well as against the existing economic order. This movement does not acquire a complete philosophy until we come to Marx, who will be considered in a later chapter. The romantic form of revolt is very different from the rationalist form, though both are derived from the French Revolution and the philosophers who immediately preceded it. The romantic form is to be seen in Byron, in an unphilosophical dress, but in Schopenhauer and Nietzsche it has learnt the language of philosophy. It tends to emphasize the will at the expense of the intellect, to be impatient of chains of reasoning, and to glorify violence of certain kinds. In practical politics, it is important as an ally of nationalism. In tendency, if not always in fact, it is definitely hostile to what is commonly called reason and tends to be anti-scientific. Some of its most extreme forms are to be found among Russian anarchists, but in Russia it was the rationalist form of revolt that finally prevailed. It was Germany, always more susceptible to romanticism than any other country, that provided a governmental outlet for the anti-rational philosophy of naked will. So far, the philosophies that we have been considering have had an inspiration which was traditional, literary, or political. But there were two other sources of philosophical opinion, namely science and machine production. The second of these began its theoretical influence with Marx, and has grown gradually more important ever since. The first has been important since the 17th century, but took new forms during the 19th century. What Galileo and Newton were to the 17th century, Darwin was to the 19th. Darwin's theory had two parts. On the one hand, there was the doctrine of evolution, which maintained that the different forms of life had developed gradually from a common ancestry. This doctrine, which is now generally accepted, was not new. It had been maintained by Lamarck and by Darwin's grandfather Erasmus, not to mention Anaximander. Darwin supplied an immense mass of evidence for the doctrine, and in the second part of his theory believed himself to have discovered the cause of evolution. He thus gave to the doctrine a popularity and a scientific force which it had not previously possessed, but he by no means originated it. The second part of Darwin's theory was the struggle for existence and the survival of the fittest. All animals and plants multiply faster than nature can provide for them. Therefore, in each generation, many perish before the age for reproducing themselves. What determines which will survive? To some extent, no doubt, sheer luck, but there is another cause of more importance. Animals and plants are, as a rule, not exactly like their parents, but differ slightly by excess or defect in every measurable characteristic. In a given environment, members of the same species compete for survival, and those best adapted to the environment have the best chance. Therefore, among chance variations, those that are favourable will preponderate, among adults in each generation. Thus, from age to age, deer run more swiftly, cats stalk their prey more silently, and giraffes' necks become longer. Given enough time, this mechanism...
of a rather special kind.
My development from the protozoa to Homo sapiens. This part of Darwin's theory has been much disputed, and is regarded by most biologists as subject to many important qualifications. That, however, is not what most concerns the historian of 19th-century ideas. From the historical point of view, what is interesting is Darwin's extension to the whole of life of the economics that characterized the philosophical radicals. The motive force of evolution, according to him, is a kind of biological economics in a world of free competition. It was Malthus's doctrine of population, extended to the world of animals and plants, that suggested to Darwin the struggle for existence and the survival of the fittest as the source of evolution. Darwin himself was a liberal, but his theories had consequences in some degree inimical to traditional liberalism. The doctrine that all men are born equal, and that the differences between adults are due wholly to education, was incompatible with his emphasis on congenital differences between members of the same species. If, as Lamarck held, and as Darwin himself was willing to concede, up to a point, acquired characteristics were inherited, this opposition to such views as those of Helvetius could have been somewhat softened. but it has appeared that only congenital characteristics are inherited, apart from certain not very important exceptions. Thus, the congenital differences between men acquire fundamental importance. There is a further consequence of the theory of evolution, which is independent of the particular mechanism suggested by Darwin. If men and animals have a common ancestry, and if men developed by such slow stages that there were creatures which we should not know whether to classify as human or not, the question arises, at what stage in evolution did men, or their semi-human ancestors, begin to be all equal? Would Pithecanthropus erectus, if he had been properly educated, have done work as good as Newton's? Would the Piltdown man have written Shakespeare's poetry if there had been anybody to convict him of poaching? A resolute egalitarian who answers these questions in the affirmative will find himself forced to regard apes as the equals of human beings. And why stop with apes? I do not see how he is to resist an argument in favour of votes for oysters. An adherent of evolution may maintain that not only the doctrine of the equality of all men, but also that of the rights of man, must be condemned as unbiological, since it makes too emphatic a distinction between men and other animals. There is, however, another aspect of liberalism, which was greatly strengthened by the doctrine of evolution, namely the belief in progress. So long as the state of the world allowed optimism, evolution was welcomed by liberals, both on this ground and because it gave new arguments against orthodox theology. Marx himself, though his doctrines are in some respects pre-Darwinian, wished to dedicate his book to Darwin. The prestige of biology caused men whose thinking was influenced by science to apply biological rather than mechanistic categories to the world. Everything was supposed to be evolving, and it was easy to imagine an imminent goal. In spite of Darwin, many men considered that evolution justified a belief in cosmic purpose. The conception of organism came to be thought the key to both scientific and philosophical explanations of natural laws, and the atomic thinking of the 18th century came to be regarded as out of date. This point of view has at last influenced even theoretical physics. In politics, it leads naturally to emphasis upon the community as opposed to the individual. This is in harmony with the growing power of the state. Also, with nationalism, which can appeal to the Darwinian doctrine of survival of the fittest, applied not to individuals, but to nations. But here we are passing into the region of extra-scientific views suggested to a large public by scientific doctrines imperfectly understood. While biology has militated against a mechanistic view of the world, modern economic technique has had an opposite effect. Until about the end of the 18th century, scientific technique, as opposed to scientific doctrines, had no important effect upon opinion. It was only with the rise of industrialism that technique began to affect men's thought. And even then, for a long time, the effect was more or less indirect. Men who produce philosophical theories are, as a rule, brought into very little contact with machinery. The Romantics noticed and hated the ugliness that industrialism was producing in places hitherto beautiful, and the vulgarity, as they considered it, of those who had made money in trade. This led them into an opposition to the middle class, which sometimes brought them into something like an alliance with the champions of the proletariat. Engels praised Carlyle, not perceiving that what Carlyle desired was not the emancipation of wage earners, but their subjection to the kind of masters they had had in the Middle Ages. The socialists welcomed industrialism, but wished to free industrial workers from subjection to the power of employers. They were influenced by industrialism in the problems that they considered, but not much in the ideas that they employed in the solution of their problems. The most important effect of machine production on the imaginative picture of the world is an immense increase in the sense of human power. This is only an acceleration of a process which began before the dawn of history, when men diminished their fear of wild animals by the invention of weapons and their fear of starvation by the invention of agriculture. But the acceleration has been so great as to produce a radically new outlook in those who wield the powers that modern technique has created. In old days, mountains and waterfalls were natural phenomena. Now an inconvenient mountain can be abolished, and a convenient waterfall can be created. In old days there were deserts and fertile regions. Now the desert can, if people think it worthwhile, be made to blossom like the rose. while fertile regions are turned into deserts by insufficiently scientific optimists. In old days, peasants lived as their parents and grandparents had lived, and believed as their parents and grandparents had believed. Not all the power of the church could eradicate pagan ceremonies, which had to be given a Christian dress by being connected with local saints. Now the authorities can decree what the children of peasants shall learn in school, and can transform the mentality of agriculturists in a generation. One gathers that this has been achieved in Russia. There thus arises, among those who direct affairs or are in touch with those who do so, a new belief in power. First, the power of man in his conflicts with nature, and then the power of rulers as against the human beings whose beliefs and aspirations they seek to control by scientific propaganda, especially education. The result is a diminution of fixity. No change seems impossible. Nature is raw material. So is that part of the human race which does not effectively participate in government. There are certain old conceptions which represent men's belief in the limits of human power. Of these, the two chief are God and truth. I do not mean that these two are logically connected. Such conceptions tend to melt away. Even if not explicitly negated, they lose importance and are retained only superficially. This whole outlook is new, and it is impossible to say how mankind will adapt itself to it. It has already produced immense cataclysms, and will no doubt produce others in the future. To frame a philosophy capable of coping with men intoxicated with the prospect of almost unlimited power, and also with the apathy of the powerless, is the most pressing task of our time. Though many still sincerely believe in human equality and theoretical democracy, the imagination of modern people is deeply affected by the pattern of social organization suggested by the organization of industry in the 19th century, which is essentially undemocratic. On the one hand, there are the captains of industry, and on the other, the mass of workers. This disruption of democracy from within is not yet acknowledged by ordinary citizens in democratic countries, but it has been a preoccupation of most philosophers from Hegel onwards, and the sharp opposition which they discovered between the interests of the many and those of the few has founded practical expression in fascism. Of the philosophers, Nietzsche was unashamedly on the side of the few, Marx wholeheartedly on the side of the many. Perhaps Bentham was the only one of importance who attempted a reconciliation of conflicting interests. He therefore incurred the hostility of both parties. To formulate any satisfactory modern ethic of human relationships, it will be essential to recognize the necessary limitations of men's power over the non-human environment and the desirable limitations of their power over each other. Chapter 22. Hegel. Hegel, 1770 to 1831, was the culmination of the movement in German philosophy that started from Kant. Although he often criticized Kant, his system could never have arisen if Kant's had not existed. His influence, though now diminishing, has been very great, not only or chiefly in Germany. At the end of the 19th century, the leading academic philosophers, both in America and in Great Britain, were largely Hegelians. Outside of pure philosophy, many Protestant theologians adopted his doctrines, and his philosophy of history profoundly affected political theory. Marx, as everyone knows, was a disciple of Hegel in his youth, and retained in his own finished system some important Hegelian features. Even if, as I myself believe, almost all Hegel's doctrines are false, he still retains an importance which is not merely historical, as the best representative of a certain kind of philosophy which in others is less coherent and less comprehensive. His life contained a few events of importance. In youth, he was much attracted to mysticism, and his later views may be regarded, to some extent, as an intellectualizing of what had first appeared to him as mystic insight. He taught philosophy, first as a Privatdozent at Jena. He mentions that he finished his Phenomenology of Mind there the day before the Battle of Jena, then at Nuremberg, then as professor at Heidelberg, 1816 to 1818, and finally at Berlin, from 1818 to his death. He was in later life a patriotic Prussian, a loyal servant of the state who comfortably enjoyed his recognized philosophical preeminence. But in his youth he despised Prussia and admired Napoleon, to the extent of rejoicing in the French victory at Jena. Hegel's philosophy is very difficult. He is, I should say, the hardest to understand of all the great philosophers. Before entering on any detail, a general characterization may prove helpful. From his early interest in mysticism, he retained a belief in the unreality of separateness. The world, in his view, was not a collection of hard units, whether atoms or souls, each completely self-subsistent. The apparent self-subsistence of finite things appeared to him to be an illusion. Nothing, he held, is ultimately and completely real except the whole. But he differed from Parmenides and Spinoza in conceiving the whole not as a simple substance, but as a complex system of the sort that we should call an organism. The apparently separate things of which the world seems to be composed are not simply an illusion. Each has a greater or lesser degree of reality, and its reality consists in an aspect of the whole, which is what it is seen to be when viewed truly. With this view goes naturally a disbelief in the reality of time and space as such, for these, if taken as completely real, involve separateness and multiplicity. All this must have come to him first as mystic insight. Its intellectual elaboration, which is given in his books, must have come later. Hegel asserts that the real is rational and the rational is real. But when he says this, he does not mean by real what an empiricist would mean. He admits, and even urges, that what to the empiricist appear to be facts are, and must be, irrational. It is only after their apparent character has been transformed by viewing them as aspects of the whole that they are seen to be rational. Nevertheless, the identification of the real and the rational leads unavoidably to some of the complacency inseparable from the belief that whatever is right. The whole, in all its complexity, is called by Hegel the absolute. The absolute is spiritual. Spinoza's view that it has the attribute of extension as well as that of thought is rejected. Two things distinguish Hegel from other men who have had a more or less similar metaphysical outlook. One of these is emphasis on logic. It is thought by Hegel that the nature of reality can be deduced from the sole consideration that it must be not self-contradictory. The other distinguishing feature, which is closely connected with the first, is the triadic movement called the dialectic. His most important books are his two logics, and these must be understood if the reasons for his views on other subjects are to be rightly apprehended. Logic, as Hegel understands the word, is declared by him to be the same thing as metaphysics. It is something quite different from what is commonly called logic. His view is that any ordinary predicate, if taken as qualifying the whole of reality, turns out to be self-contradictory. One might take as a crude example the theory of Parmenides, that the one, which alone is real, is spherical. Nothing can be spherical unless it has a boundary, and it cannot have a boundary unless there is something, at least empty space, outside of it. Therefore, to suppose the universe as a whole to be spherical is self-contradictory. This argument might be questioned by bringing in non-Euclidean geometry, but as an illustration it will serve. Or let us take another illustration, still more crude, far too much so to be used by Hegel. You may say, without apparent contradiction, that Mr. A is an uncle. But if you were to say that the universe is an uncle, you would land yourself in difficulties. An uncle is a man who has a nephew, and the nephew is a separate person from the uncle. Therefore, an uncle cannot be the whole of reality. This illustration might also be used to illustrate the dialectic, which consists of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. First we say, reality is an uncle. This is the thesis. But the existence of an uncle implies that of a nephew. Since nothing really exists except the absolute, and we are now committed to the existence of a nephew, we must conclude, the absolute is a nephew. This is the antithesis. But there is the same objection to this as to the view that the absolute is an uncle. Therefore, we are driven to the view that the absolute is the whole composed of uncle and nephew. This is the synthesis. But this synthesis is still unsatisfactory, because a man can be an uncle only if he has a brother or sister who is a parent of the nephew. Hence, we are driven to enlarge our universe to include the brother or sister with his wife or her husband. In this sort of way, so it is contended, we can be driven on by the mere force of logic from any suggested predicate of the absolute to the final conclusion of the dialectic, which is called the absolute idea. Throughout the whole process, there is an underlying assumption that nothing can be really true unless it is about reality as a whole. For this underlying assumption, there is a basis in traditional logic, which assumes that every proposition has a subject and a predicate. According to this view, every fact consists in something having some property. It follows that relations cannot be real since they involve two things, not one. Uncle is a relation, and a man may become an uncle without knowing it. In that case, from an empirical point of view, the man is unaffected by becoming an uncle. He has no quality which he did not have before. If by quality we understand something necessary to describing him as he is in himself, apart from his relations to other people and things. The only way in which the subject-predicate logic can avoid this difficulty is to say that the truth is not a property of the uncle alone, or of the nephew alone, but of the whole composed of uncle and nephew. Since everything, except the whole, has relations to outside things, it follows that nothing quite true can be said about separate things, and that in fact only the whole is real. This follows more directly from the fact that A and B are two is not a subject-predicate proposition, and therefore, on the basis of the traditional logic, there can be no such proposition. Therefore, there are not as many as two things in the world. Therefore, the whole, considered as a unity, is alone real. The above argument is not explicit in Hegel, but is implicit in his system, as in that of many other metaphysicians. A few examples of Hegel's dialectic method may serve to make it more intelligible. He begins the argument of his logic by the assumption that the absolute is pure being. We assume that it just is, without assigning any qualities to it. But pure being without any qualities is nothing. Therefore, we are led to the antithesis, the absolute is nothing. From this, thesis and antithesis, we pass on to the synthesis. The union of being and not being is becoming. And so we say, the absolute is becoming. This also, of course, won't do, because there has to be something that becomes. In this way, our views of reality develop by the continual correction of previous errors, all of which arose from undue abstraction by taking something finite or limited as if it could be the whole. The limitations of the finite do not come merely from without. Its own nature is the cause of its abrogation, and by its own act it passes into its counterpart.